Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. This is part two of a special two-part series on weird courtship rituals throughout, you know, human history. We're not getting to all of them, but we found some weird ones. That's the one and only Max Williams. They call me Ben. Noel, how are you doing, man?
I'm good, man. I'm feeling really good about this premeditated two-parter. Peek behind the curtain. Usually, we end up just kind of like making them two-parters because we'd like to get an extra episode out of it, or it runs a little long. But, you know, this is special, not only because of the premeditated nature of it, but because we are joined by our friends, Diane and Eli, once again, to talk about more ridiculous, weird, bizarro courtships from across the world.
Thanks for coming, guys.
Oh, thanks for having us again.
Oh my gosh, so much fun.
Yeah.
Now, in our previous episode, we dove pretty deep into some literally puritanical dating practices. We also traveled to Mauritania, where we looked at an ancient, ongoing, tremendously controversial pre-marriage practice, a very specific kind of terrible summer camp. And today, we're going to two completely different locations in the world. I've got to ask, though, before we begin, did you guys find this episode that we recorded earlier, did you find it staying with you over the weekend? Like, Diana, were you trying to find, like, a courting tube to talk to Eli or anything like that?
I guess I wasn't. I wasn't trying to find a tube or anything. I did consider putting an apple in my ear. I just scream across the house. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we wouldn't have a tube long enough to reach between the rooms when we're working.
That's true.
I have to say, I did discuss bundling with my girlfriend. Not like that we should do it or anything, but you know, it was good conversation, and she didn't know about it. And so I hope that that episode armed all you ridiculous historians out there with some good conversation for your significant others, or, you know, to look smart at parties, because that's what we're here for.
Yeah, totally.
Well, grab your thimbles and
shear off the bottoms of them.
Yes.
Yep.
And strap in for part two. What are we talking about? It's funny because off air, we were talking with each other before we started rolling, and our conversation was, you know, some podcasts just seem to constantly allude to stuff they did or stuff they were talking about that's not on air. We decided we're not going to be those folks today, at least. If you want to hear in detail what we're talking about just a few minutes ago, then tune into part one of Weird Courtship Rituals. This episode will still make sense, but it's you know, it's more rewarding if you get the whole like narrative arc that we worked on. So we'll pause for the magic of podcasting to give everybody a chance to get caught up. There. Great. Fantastic. So you've listened to part one. We're ready for part two. Where do we go first? Let's say, I never get the chance to talk about this country on air. Can we go to Bhutan?
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Let's please talk about Bhutan. Today, I wanted to talk about a practice in Bhutan called Bomina. It's also known more colloquially as night hunting. And this is something that's mostly fallen out of practice in Bhutan, but it still exists in rural areas. It's a very old tradition. Bomina literally means going towards a girl. And that sounds sweet, right?
Well, I don't know. It depends on how you're going towards the girl.
That's fair.
What energy are you bringing in your approach?
It sounds more like you're coming at her, like perhaps brandishing some sort of weapon.
Yeah. Are you running? Are you strolling? I need more information.
Well, it's worse than any of that, because the practice is that in theory, any man can, after nightfall, climb the house of the walls of a girl, jimmy open her window, climb into her room, slip into her bed, and sleep with her that night. Pretty exciting stuff. Sounds pretty horrific. And in truth, this is a very old practice. Bhutan is a matriarchal society. For example, the daughters inherit property from their parents. But a lot of rural folks, especially, and older folks, like, really believe in this tradition. A lot of people will say their grandparents met this way, and it's very sweet, and they love it. Originally, it was meant to give the women actually more control, because they decide, when the boy shows up at the house, whether or not he's allowed into the bed or not.
Sure, but he could just knock on the door, and I could be right. Like, oh, no, thank you, and close the door. Why do you have to climb in at the dead of night and break and enter into my house like a weird burglar?
Yeah, well, exactly. And this has been kind of the problem with it, especially recently. A woman, Sonam Wangdi from the Trongsa village, married a man that she met through Bomina, and she said, "Before marriage, I had lost count of the men who visited me. It's not about forcing. The tradition gives freedom to the women to choose, but there are some men who force themselves. It is for the exploitation of innocent women that the custom has lost its beauty." So, surprise, this didn't go very well forever.
You gave them an inch and they took a mile.
Oh, I know. It just seems like it's asking for trouble. It sounds like something out of like a Chaucer story. Like, I feel like that is a thing from the Canterbury Tales. Like, you know, I think it was more of like a cuckolding husband situation or cuckolding.
Oh, yeah. The line in Chaucer, I think, is, I can't remember if it's the Miller's Tale. It's one of the ones that I actually finished. But there's this scene in Chaucer where there's this guy who just won't take no for an answer. He's trying to get this girl to lean out of the window and kiss him, and it's really dark, and she does put something out the window, and he does kiss it, but it's not her front end.
Ah, yes, that's right. Wow. It's all coming back to me now. So, okay, you say the beauty has gone out of it? I'm sorry, I don't quite understand where the
good old days of breaking and entering. What happened? Right,
you know? Used to be so gorgeous.
I mean, there has to be more to this. Like, I mean, you say it gives the young woman more agency, but at the same time, like, you know, dudes be aggressive.
Right.
They're exactly. Coming into your window.
So, traditionally, this is in like small towns. Everybody kind of knows each other. And what really is happening is, generally speaking, the boy and the girl would have met up beforehand at social events. They've seen each other. And typically this was agreed upon, but not always. Sometimes they just show up. In either case, the guy has to be super quiet because most of these families all sleep in the same room. And so if she decides to make any noise, dad wakes up and they are just as protective as fathers anywhere. And they will literally throw this guy out the window. Some have been chased away with scalding hot water. So it really doesn't go well for anyone.
Right. It kind of reminds me of bundling a little bit, like where they got permission beforehand. They sleep in the same bed. All the parents are around.
Right.
You got to be real quiet.
You still have to be quiet. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. They're carving out these carving out these areas of social plausible deniability. Right. Well, I don't know. I don't want to jump ahead too far, but what's the birth control situation?
It is bad.
Okay.
And that is one of the major problems here is unplanned pregnancies and not knowing who the fathers are. Again, in smaller villages, they say usually you know who the father is because, you know, 50 people live here. We know who's with who and we can figure it out pretty easily. And there are DNA tests. But especially even in some of the rural areas and in cities, they're saying it's expensive for these DNA paternity tests to come through. And often, here's the kicker. Here's what's really made it, taken the beauty out of it, as they say, is that in these small towns, even where everyone's pretty comfortable with the tradition, you have people coming in from out of town and taking advantage of this practice. And they're like, if the father ends up being someone who's an expatriate or sometimes even a monk, they say that the courts can't do anything for paternity. And the woman's left on her own. Also, without knowing who the father is, it's very difficult to get the child registered on their census. Sometimes it takes up to 6 or 8 years, and the children can't even start schooling until they know who the father is.
Wait, so no government services up to and including like the public school system?
Yeah, they have to be registered through the census first. And that for that, you need paternity.
Wow.
Or a very lengthy process without it.
So wait, so when you say 8 years to get registered with the census, that means you no school until
right.
you're eight?
Right.
At all?
Right.
I mean, I guess, you know, Who needs kindergarten? You know, who needs primary school?
You know, as a guy who had to repeat kindergarten, you don't learn that much. Life can go on without it. But I think
ABCs,
it's mainly,
1, 2, 3s.
I think it's mainly socialization, but we know also that Bhutan has, in terms of who they consider citizens in general, it gets kind of tricky, right? I believe there's a Nepalese descended population there that is still struggling for the same rights as people the kingdom considers native Bhutanese. Is that correct? Yeah.
So there was this huge movement about this online in social media in around 2012. It kind of came up and they organized like an NGO, a nonprofit, to start helping the women and start bringing attention to this practice. And there was a journalist who wrote, her name is Ravindar Bawa, and she had written into the email address that they provided, and the government answered them and said, "The two girls who used this email have surrendered it to the government. They have been educated, and now they are not going to talk about anything like this," which actually does not happen in Bhutan anymore.
Ooh, that is dark.
So it was getting a real cover-up. And they say that's because the government just isn't really able to track it very well, so they don't really admit to it very much. Defenders of the practice say, well, urban people in Bhutan and people who don't live in Bhutan are criticizing rural areas and othering them for this practice and saying they're less civilized and that they're blaming unwanted pregnancies and venereal diseases on this practice as if they don't have those problems in the cities. But they do. And they say, you know, getting rid of Bomina would not magically erase all those problems because you all have them too. So that's been kind of the cultural argument between defenders and people who think this is absolutely insane. That you can just break into a woman's house at night.
Ugh.
So this is something that's done with the consent and understanding of the parents? Like, this is a conversation that happens?
It doesn't necessarily happen with the parents. Often it happens with the boy and girl beforehand, and you literally have to go in and sneak your way in. What they said is, again, in smaller villages where they sort of know who's coming in and who isn't, the parents will sometimes lie awake knowing that the boy is broken in if they think he's a good suitor for marriage. Because also, if you are seen in the bed in the morning, the boys will often sneak out. But if they're seen there when they wake up, they're pretty much married.
Don't sleep in.
Pretty much locks it in.
No one sleep in.
Yeah.
Okay. You can come over, but you can't stay.
it seems like there's some traditional constraints. But this practice itself, in addition to being, you know, a hot button issue and quite controversial, it seems like this practice is undergoing some cultural pressures because this sounds like it's still more often than not going to happen in rural areas instead of like the capital Thimphu. But there are tourists in Bhutan now, not a ton, but I imagine they breeze through the more rural, you know, eastern areas of the country. How do they interact with this? Is this a Bhutanese-only kind of operation?
I think the Bhutanese would love that, but it's not necessarily. They say that, you know, again, tourists from out of the country or even from other towns sometimes or other cities will take up the practice on their own and try to go sneak into a girl's room at night. And if they're aware of it, they take advantage of it. And this is one of the things that has led to the most problems with the whole culture. You know, other people taking advantage of it, again, unwanted pregnancies and not knowing who the father is because these guys slip in and out from out of town. Sometimes boys are even quoted, you know, they talked to a man who was married through this practice. He and his wife both supported it because it worked out great for them. And in that same conversation, he says, well, you know, and before I met my wife, of course, you know, you got to have a little trial and error first. And sometimes my friends and I would just go over to the next town to have some fun. So, you know, literally going somewhere where no one's going to know who they are so they can sneak away again without any consequences of their own.
Yikes.
I guess it would feel less problematic if there were more interviews or more statements from people saying, yeah, some guy might show up at my house, but if I don't like him, I do tell him to go away and he does go away.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find any of those?
Yes. So, I mean, some of the women, especially, again, usually it was women maybe 40 or older, or mm-hmm. even older than that is when it was more kind of standard and practiced regularly, who really defended it and said, yeah, I kicked out guys until I found the man I loved and had no trouble with it. But often those arguments were pretty dismissive of the women who definitely did have trouble with it, of the bad experiences. You know, they kind of took their own and said, no, it's fine.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I do wonder, though, sometimes if maybe, you know, since it is a practice that in this matriarchal society seems to, you know, have its roots in empowerment, that maybe there are some women that didn't have the best experiences, but in the interest of like being team players, maybe sugarcoated it a little bit. I don't know. It's certainly a possibility.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility because, you know, you get that impression, especially from like the NGOs that have been set up to sort of try and fight this practice, that they're saying, you know, a lot of these women don't have a voice in speaking out against this, whether they don't have, you know, the reach or whatever they might need to sort of speak out against it, the opportunity, the platform, they sort of pick and choose, you know, what you're hearing about it. So,
right. It's interesting. There's actually, this is almost a weird flip side of the story that I'm going to tell, or the tradition that I'm going to talk about. I'm kind of glad you led, because this is sort of like two sides of this very strange coin, both striving for empowerment. I think one perhaps succeeding a little bit more.
Right.
I don't want to spoil it quite
well,
yet.
Well, again, you know, this is one of those things where we have to realize that Bhutan is very much, for the majority of the world, an inaccessible place. It's if you're not familiar with the country, it is mountainous. It is incredibly difficult to get to, partially historically due to geography, but nowadays also due to decisions of the government. Of the monarchy, which I believe that if you want to travel to Bhutan as an outsider, there are pretty exorbitant fees you pay per day. Tourists also cannot exceed like a certain quota per year, but in their favor, Bhutan has the distinction of being the only country to rate its overall success not on gross domestic product or anything like that, but on gross national happiness, which is. Oh. Pretty difficult to quantify. It sounds like it could get confusing, and also makes me wonder, you know, how does this process of night hunting fit into a modernizing country, right? Because it sounds like this is very old, as we see the prevalence of things like cell phones, I think would be the number one next step, right? As we see the proliferation of those in rural areas, How is that going to affect things? Like, what happens when people start? Because I get the sense, I'm searching for an analogy. I get the sense when I hear people, some of the guys talk about this, they're talking about it like, me and my buddies went out to the bar, or we went out to the club.
Oh, yeah. Did a little night hunting.
Yeah. Right.
Like,
right.
Like, can't you phone ahead at this point? I think you're getting
seriously.
At that.
Ben?
No, and it would even happen in groups. Sometimes groups of guys will go out and one at a time break off and pick a house and pretty much just like that.
Ugh. Is that not kind of terrifying though? Like,
100%.
That's what I'm trying to understand. Like, is there a demographic? Like, does this stop when you get married, if you're female identified, or is it like the purge? Basically,
right.
You have to lock your if based on your genitalia. Do you have to lock yourself in at right. dusk?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that directly, but my thoughts are that it probably stops when you're getting married. At least if you already have a man in your bed, you know,
that's
at least
true.
It might
like,
get as far as the window.
Three's a crowd.
But at the same time, it feels like the practice does open because of, you know, if you lean into this as like, no, I'm just doing the thing, you know, like it really is just kind of like a carte blanche invitation to, you know, stalk people. You
Absolutely.
Know? Yeah.
Yeah. There was a girl who was in college in a rural area and she had no idea this. She said she had heard of the practice, but didn't really know much about it or think that it was still happening. And one night she's, you know, in her room with her roommate and some guy comes up and starts banging on the window and says, hey, let me in. No, it's OK. This is a normal thing. And, you know, spent quite a bit of time harassing
her. You've convinced me.
Yeah, I know, right? It's also a normal thing for me to say, no, sir, get out. Yeah. Like, that's part of it. Yep. So get out. Like, that's...
It's very based on coercion, right? I think that's one of the biggest problems here, too, is even if the guy gets in, then he's got to talk himself into the bed. Mm. If he doesn't force himself, you know? So even if there's not a physical forcing, there's still a lot of coercion going on.
I'm wondering, too, if there's, like, I'm not aware of this, but if there's a situation where someone travels from outside the country to maybe do some NGO work or something, and then they find themselves accidentally sucked into this practice. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Is it? I guess it depends on how common it is in the modern day, but now that you explain it this way, I can see a lot of very angry dads and moms.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So if you're caught... So it's vampire rules, kind of, right? Like,
let the right one in.
Right. If you're caught, and if you're caught at dawn, that's, you're married.
Yeah, that doesn't always play, but that traditionally that's how it goes. So that's very strict in some villages.
So do you feel like this is the society normal? Would we normally consider them pretty conservative?
I suppose I didn't get that impression, but I think so. I think it seems more traditional in their, values of marriage and family, things like that. Pretty traditional.
It seems odd to me that in a matriarchal society, they would care so much about establishing paternity for citizenship, right. or for, right. I guess not for citizenship, but for registering you and all that stuff. Like, I wonder what that is. I don't know. I just was surprised by that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because from what I'm understanding, as a matriarchal society, what we're saying there is that women are traditionally the head of the family and also call the shots, right? So if there are questions of a household import, then it would typically be the mom or the oldest female relative, mm-hmm. I guess, that makes those decisions. So maybe it's a situation where you need to be especially like, if there are two kids who are like dating and trying night hunting, they know each other right. already. Maybe it's the mom that they're really afraid of, right?
Could be. Yeah. I mean, I've definitely heard that the dads were the throw you out the window type.
But they're not the brains of the operation.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right.
They're the bouncer. Yeah. You got to get past the manager to get to the VIP room.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the way he came in. Might as well go on back out that way. Yeah, this is super interesting and bizarre. So it's definitely fallen out of favor, or
it has. And
little
this is
pockets
this,
of it. Yeah,
this is sort of the remaining argument is that more rural and older people are saying, while the modern world of dating and Western dating has crept into Bhutan, especially in the cities, and that's taking the love out of it, like we used to have. The good old days of breaking into a window. Yeah.
The old B&E. That's how you do it.
The romantic practice of crawling into my bed in the middle of the night.
And it's become this, kind of a mini cultural war, because you've got, again, urban folks saying this is outrageous if they've even heard of it. You're getting more and more young people who, will grow up their whole lives and never even heard of this practice. And more the ones who have are saying, this is so primitive and dangerous and really calling out, using it as a way to call out rural areas, and that they're less cultured and less civilized and backwards.
Okay.
And so those areas are saying, no, this is a perfectly safe practice. We love it. Yeah, there's some, a couple of little weak links in the chain, but they defend it and, say that that's just an attack on their culture.
Yeah, that's the thing that's tough about culture and these types of rituals that we're talking about,
right.
Especially the ones that are a little, more problematic. I mean, it's hard to criticize them, especially as an outsider, without coming off as just being some sort of ignorant interloper. Even though, in terms of just human rights and stuff, this does seem pretty pretty dangerous and problematic, especially when it's taken advantage of and kind of run roughshod over in terms of the maybe original intent,
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I think, hopefully those NGOs, those nonprofits that are growing in Bhutan are working to find that right balance I know they signed the CEDAW, the Convention of Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, in 1980. And sort of what started to bring up this. They said Bomina-like customs were a form of gender discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
So that's had some work done locally.
Right. That was going to be one of my other questions. So this, the reverse of this doesn't happen. There are no young men who are sleeping and then someone bangs into their house and is like, okay, this, hi, I'm from earlier. I thought you were cute.
Yeah. As far as I know, I've never heard of that happening.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's right. Funny too, for a matriarchal society that still you're dependent on the man's interest in you and his interest, you know, his willingness to kind of come get you. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I would assume that a matriarchal society would be like, and come here.
Right.
Let's talk. I guess there's certainly different shades of that, right? I mean, like different extremes and flavors of what a matriarchal society means. Like, I mean, I know a lot of very strong women in my life, you know, for example, like my mother, who is also very, very old school, you know, like she's like, oh, the man has to come for the woman. And when young ladies should wear dresses, like my kid kind of dresses like a weird punk rock goth, and my mom finds this very off-putting, and she's always trying to dress her up in these little outfits, as opposed to what I would think would be looking at it as like, oh, it's so cool that she's like letting her freak flag fly and doing her thing and, you know, owning her own image and her own you know, kind of sense of self. But that's not really how it goes. And so I think sometimes there are things that run counter to that because of generational stuff, I think, and especially when you start getting into these cultures that have their own set of rules,
norms and taboos. Right. And also, you know, it's interesting. I was doing some, doing just a little bit of digging. I see that women traditionally were able to practice polyandry and have more than one husband, typically brothers in these rural areas. What I'm saying is, it sounds like night hunting exists in a larger cultural context, and the whole thing is starting to change. And that's got to be a lot to experience, because I don't know if it's still the case, but I think up until fairly recently, people were required to wear, like legally required to wear, traditional dress in the country as well.
Oh, interesting. Wow. Yeah.
So also, I don't know how that affects. I mean, we're joking about it, but they're breaking into people's houses.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's outrageous. And the results are clear, too. You have women who've been interviewed who say, I won't even talk to men anymore. I've been abused many times. This one woman had a man came in, you know, and they slept together. She got pregnant. They married. And then as soon as her first child was born, he disappeared. And then it happened to her again. A man came in, Bomina style, wooed her one night, and then he disappeared as soon as they found out she was pregnant. And so she has two children and says, you know, she was abused more than that, even, you know, at times when she wasn't even as, you know, didn't agree to it. And she says, I don't even talk to men anymore. And you're finding more and more women like that, too, who've been abused through this practice. And, you know, it's really affected them and their whole lives. And it's affecting the culture of these towns, too.
Well, Eli, thanks for bringing this one to us.
Yeah.
Definitely something that I wasn't aware of, and I think probably that's going to be the case for a lot of folks. And like I said, interesting kind of kindred tradition to the one I'm going to talk about right after this word from our sponsor. Okay, and we're back with a proactive coming back from an ad. Max, how are you liking this? Are you going to make us do this from now on?
Oh, please do this.
No deal. No, stop breaking our traditions, man.
It's a tradition. Thank you, tradition. Remember that? What is that? Fiddler on the Roof? No, seriously, traditions are they're a big deal. I mean, we have plenty that, you know, folks from outside of America would probably think are odd, like, you know, flying an American flag on, I don't know, what's
slapping
a weird
armadillos.
That's not
paying,
a thing.
Blood for sacrifice.
Thank you. Let's get to it.
It hurts. I can't laugh too hard. I'll hurt myself.
And today seems to have kind of accidentally been about you know, traditions that attempt to empower women. I would argue, Eli, that yours is maybe a little bit misguided and doesn't really succeed in doing that. And I'm not saying that I'm like coming in and being like Mr. Woke guy or whatever, but this one that I'm bringing, I kind of think does succeed. Okay. And Marie Claire would agree. So Marie Claire,
we've been doing a lot for them recently.
No, it's true. But what we're talking about today is something in Cambodia. I couldn't find a pronunciation. It's K-R-E-U-N-G. I think I'm going to call it Krang or Krong. An ethnic minority group called the Krong living in Cambodia have for generations been practicing this thing called the Love Hut. It's the little old place where we can get together. It really is. What it is a building built outside of the home where young women are able to entertain gentlemen callers on their own terms. There's also a really good article on Vice about this practice by Aisha Down. And Down actually goes to Cambodia, where this is still being practiced today. And essentially what it does is it allows women, you know, adolescent women coming into, you know, adulthood to kind of try out partners, you know? I mean, date, essentially.
There you go.
Swing, okay. Even. All right. I mean, it really is. It's about the sex. That's certainly part of it. It's about finding out whether you and a potential mate are sexually and intellectually compatible. Essentially, you know, you have this little hut that's out behind the main house, and it's like the young woman's room. That's where she lives and she hangs out, and she's able to kind of make it her own and entertain boys, you know, quite a few before she ultimately decides which one to marry.
I don't want to sound too old fashioned here, Noel, but what's the age range we're talking about?
Yeah, so that's a good question, man. It's a little odd. It's about 13 to 15. So like I said, literally at the beginning of puberty. And, you know, as a father of a 12-year-old girl, this, you know, certainly that age range strikes me a little odd. But again, it does ultimately lead to this notion of sex as not being some sort of tool of a patriarchy to kind of, you know, or like a, literally just a tool for procreation. It's all about procreation.
It's not vilified either.
It's not vilified. I'm sorry. Thank you, Ben. I'm totally stammering to try to get that out. That's exactly right. It's normalized, the idea of sex. The idea of partnership being something that requires like compatibility in terms of like people's ability to even have conversations. In the 2011 Marie Claire piece that I mentioned, Fiona McGregor actually goes and visits the Krung tribe and hangs out with several young women to talk about their sex life and what this hut is all about. And the quotes that you hear from these women are just so self-possessed, like in terms of like, they just own it. They own themselves. Yeah. And they don't really think of it as like unusual at all, because it's something that's been passed down to them for generations. And it's just like what you do. The father, when the young woman begins to reach puberty, builds this hut out back, and then she moves out there. So it's almost like it's giving agency not only over like independence in terms of like living outside of the home, but it really puts, you know, the impetus of all of these things directly on the woman. And consequently, like there's like no rape in this culture, in the Krung culture at all. Like practically zero. Sexual violence, incredibly rare. Rape is apparently non-existent, according to the Marie Claire story. And speaking to one of the elders, I suppose, or one of the parents of one of the women who Fiona McGregor interviews, they say, "We don't worry about female purity. Who knows what a girl does when she goes to another village anyway?"
Amazing. Awesome.
I mean, I love it. We're just so used to, in the United States, which we consider ourselves to be so, like, you know, I guess forward thinking and right, like, you know, progressive in terms of so many things. Still so much weird puritanical kind of like attitude towards sex here. It's sort of either like the extreme kind of like flagrant, you know, just like over sex kind of attitude, like in terms of like what we see in TV and film and advertisement and stuff. And then you have like this extreme polar opposite, which is like a very kind of devout notion of like women need to get married and like get a husband and, you know, be a housewife and all that. I think there is still some of that attitude. It's certainly changed and progressed over the years, but I just think it's so interesting that these folks who are literally living, you know, in nature, I mean, they really are living in like their actual huts that they live in are made of bamboo, yeah. And they have to rebuild them like every year or so because like, you know, the weather can get insane there.
Yeah.
So it really is like they're living directly, you know, with nature. And then they build these other huts out back. So I don't know, you guys, I'd love to hear your thoughts, Diana, especially like, I mean, you being like a woman and all, how does this strike you? I mean, I think it's really fascinating and it's such an interesting, you know, thing to read about, especially we'll get to the kind of status of it and, you know, the future of it now, but it is still kind of a thing.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. It was funny that you said puritanical because, you know, I did all those Puritan courtship things. And part of bundling was that you expected to have some sexual contact. You just weren't meant to get pregnant.
Right.
And
hand
then
stuff.
Yeah. And then the idea came around that women were very pure and asexual and didn't have any sexual desire at all. Like that was the ideal woman. And that's when bundling kind of stopped happening. So it's just interesting to me that they're like, no, women like sex. They like it. And it's a part of life and it's a part of marriage. And of course you should try on some pants and see what fits. You know what I mean? Like, why not? So I just think that's really a very enlightened way of thinking about it.
I also like the way that the situation has been described. Whenever you hear stories like this, if you're in the West, you have to be very careful to corroborate sources and make sure you're not getting some unfairly exoticized or, as you said earlier, Eli, othered kind of accounts. But even with that, in some of the articles I read, I really like the way they painted the scene. The guys aren't just busting into these huts, to be clear. Like they kick it on the stoop and they play some music, you know, and you know, they do like their Wonderwall or whatever their version of
Peter Gabriel.
For some reason in my head, you know, I don't know what pop music is popular there now, but I want it to be something like really specific. It would be hilarious if it was Smash Mouth's All Star and it was like just a very slow acoustic version. And then, you know, if
and she's like, yeah, we could all use a little change.
So get out. So the thing is, apparently, if, like you said, Noel, the consent is key. So if the, I'm going to say child, if they're 13, if the child is not interested, then they just politely talk for a little while and then the boy moves on. So there's no like there's no entrance into this thing without the consent of the person living in the maiden hut,
right,
which I think is great.
Well, I like the way you describe that, Ben. It reminds me of Noel, you saying that it goes kind of back to nature, and you know, it sort of feels like these more animal like rituals of having to woo. The male has to come over and show his fancy feathers in order to get the female interested, and that's I kind of like that idea.
Yeah, me too. Where's my fancy feathers?
Oh, you dig it a hole, Eli.
But it also just kind of goes to show how so many of these ideas are like constructs of, you know, that we kind of build for ourselves.
Right.
And unfortunately, even the Krung people are not completely oblivious to that, or completely not, you know, affected by these things, because these practices have kind of started to wane a little bit. And that's largely because, so, okay, a big part of it was the functionality of it. Very much like your story, Diana, where the Puritans lived in these tiny, you know, single common area homes. That's the same with the Krung people. They have these, like I said, very rudimentary kind of bamboo huts. So it was like, kind of like, it made sense that when, you know, a girl reached the certain age to move her out because they wanted the space, and also they didn't have a wooing tube or whatever it's called, and bundling wasn't exactly a thing. but this is not that different. I mean, you're like, mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that it was sort of the leadership of the church that walked back bundling and, yeah. and sort of took that agency away from women that was already there. And what's happening here is, as you know, technology kind of reaches these areas. Again, this article was from 2011. Lots happened since then in terms of just like the exponential availability of technology and just like, you know, the affordability as well. And even like, you know, things like access to the internet, like even in like these really, really remote areas. So what's happening is there's also more wealth kind of pouring into some of these more rural, you know, areas, which causes
building materials, right?
Different building materials. Yeah. So instead of using bamboo and these kind of temporary structures and having this reason to kind of keep this tradition going, now they're building their homes out of brick and concrete and such, and they want all of their rooms to be contained within the one house. So it doesn't make sense to build it. And then the tradition of it all kind of falls apart at that point, right?
Right.
And it just seems like this is something that is maybe going to disappear. And that's actually what the article on Vice is about. It's called The Struggle to Save Teen Love Huts in Cambodia. They're also referred to as maiden huts. But the thing is, all of the stories that I've read about the relationships that these led to, they last lifetime. I mean, like, there's like very little divorce as well. And like, you know, because you have a chance to actually get to know your partner, both sexually and, you know, in terms of like, hey, I like to hang out with you because you're, you know, we actually have things in common. And honestly, it's the conversation that sort of starts the whole thing. And if a woman decides like, oh, this dude's dull, like she can just kick him right on out. Or sometimes they'll just snuggle and sleep in the same room, but there won't be maybe some hand stuff, all of the Puritans, but that's it. And then there's no hard feelings, right?
Yeah.
And there's no concept of jealousy. There, again, like we said, sexual violence and rape are very, 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 very rare. But just the idea of jealousy is like not a thing. You kind of just accept it and move on. And it's all because of what the woman wants. And I don't know, I think it's great.
One thing that feels important to mention here is that this is a practice in the Highlands, right? This is a specific community, a specific people. So it's not Cambodia overall.
No. It's specifically in an area or a village called Krola, in an area called Ratan Akiri in Cambodia. It's, like I said, very much, you know, in deep wooded kind of areas.
And Cambodia itself, we know, is incredibly conservative when it comes to ideas of things like divorce. I think their divorce rate was like back, this is an old stat, but back in the late 90s, their divorce rate was 2.4%, at least their official one, because it would be a costly process. So I'm saying that if the culture is like the culture in the rest of Cambodia, divorce is supposed to be an extremely shameful affair. So just to point out, it may be possible that there are people stuck in unhappy marriages. But to be fair, that happens in the United States, where divorce is much easier. So
I was about to ask if you knew if they did kind of what we did when we couldn't divorce, which was the guy would kind of go off and do whatever. And the lady would like have like a guy just hang out with her. Like, no, we're not married. We're not married. We just live together for years.
Yeah, so let's not quibble over semantics.
They were roommates.
Yeah, like this I wonder if they have anything like that. Yes, we just have a kid together, but it's no big deal, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't know specifically how they handle divorce or how they handle, you know, separation like that. But it is kind of sad that these maiden huts or love huts really are much, much, much more rare these days. There certainly are pockets where it still goes on, but it is just becoming increasingly more unusual. And it's the Vice article actually interviews a Cha Bai, who was 15 in the early 60s. So that's when this was kind of maybe at its peak. And that's, she describes kind of her experience back when she was young and how different things are now. So really, really interesting.
Sounds like it's the original She Shed.
there it is.
It gives me two questions. I guess, one, are these girls permitted to, is this a voluntary thing? If girls are just like, I don't want a love shack. I don't want to build one. Is that something? And then also, it seems you know, it's very heterosexually driven.
Sure.
I don't know if that ever comes up.
Yeah, no, nothing that I've seen, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I don't want to, you know, conjecture, but I wouldn't be surprised given the kind of progressive nature of this whole practice if even things like same-sex, you know, relationships were a little more, a little less frowned upon. But again, I haven't really seen anything about that specifically.
Right.
But as far as like, you know, are they forced to do this? I honestly think it's just always kind of looked at as a privilege, and it was so ingrained kind of in the culture, and it gives you so much control. And, you know, it is ultimately about getting married. Like, I mean, I think you're right. I get what you're saying. You like, what if I don't want to get married? What if I just want to be single? And that's not something that's important to me. I think that part of it is a little arm twisty, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, so there is still some, you know, forcing young women to fit into a certain mold, but at least it's on their own terms.
I'm seeing the Disney Pixar princess who doesn't want to do the Love Shack thing, and, you know, goes on a journey instead.
Or doesn't want to leave. I think you can stay in until your 20s.
Sure.
Oh, I was about to ask, do they get married really early? Because I know you said it was like 12 to 15. Is that when they start?
Yeah, it's unclear as to if there's like a clock on it. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
okay.
But it's as far as like how long do you have to make your decision? Like, are people like really breathing down your neck about it? Your parents? I kind of get the sense that they are to a degree. But again, today, according to this Vice article, women or young girls rather are often married by the time they're 12 13. So it does.
See, I was a bit of a late bloomer. Yeah. So I feel like if I, you know, I wasn't really interested in boys or anything like that until I was at least 16.
Easily.
You know, I didn't really care about that. So I was like, I would be like, damn, I missed my chance for my love hut.
Exactly.
Now I just got to pick one.
That's a good point.
The Cha Bai mentioned earlier said that people would stay in there up until they were 25.
Okay.
So it seems like it goes, while the beginning may hinge on, you know, signs of puberty or something like that, it looks like the maiden in the maiden hut has a lot of latitude and agency to decide when they're done or when they find their partner. But again, there are a lot of, you know, in these communities, there may be a lot of other pressures that we're not aware of that might push someone into a marriage of some sort.
Well, and what about birth control? Are there a lot of teen pregnancies?
What about
some
birth control?
No, it's definitely a thing. There are unplanned pregnancies, but, you know, again, talking or reading interviews with some of these young women, they understand safe sex. And they practice it. If there ever is an unplanned pregnancy, it is, you know, a situation where the man has to provide for that child.
So even if they don't get married, he still has responsibility for.
Yep.
Okay, that's
very
cool.
Much so. I don't think it instantly means they have to get married either. According to this Marie Claire article, typically, if this happens, they will get married. But at the end of the day, if the girl does not choose him, the man still has to, you know, provide for the child and raise the child as his own.
All right.
So there you have it. Two very different, but kind of weirdly spiritually entwined kind of stories of courtship.
Yeah, I like that we went around the world in this series. And there's something else that happened. We mentioned in part one, I think I noted that we're barely scratching the surface because we found so many other odd things, right? And and of course, we have to be aware of cultural bias. The United States is full of very strange courtship rituals. Historians are going to look back like, what the hell were they doing? You know? And so I personally can't wait to hear more people's stories of unique courtship customs. But I also can't wait to hear more ridiculous romance. Diana, Eli, thank you both so much for joining us for part two. Can you give the Ridiculous Historians a little bit of a spoiler for some episodes you guys are working on?
Oh, yeah. We got a great, this whole week coming up now, we're going to be looking at two very powerful couples who, the women of which, wives of rulers, who had an incredible influence on those rules. So we're talking about Winston and Clementine Churchill, and particularly Clementine's influence on World War II, which is really only uncovered in the last few years. And it's outrageous. We would all be speaking German today if it weren't for Clementine Churchill, quite likely.
Absolutely. Wow.
Yeah.
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 And then we also went to ancient Egypt in BC times to hear about Amenhotep III and his powerful queen, Tiye. And she was, it's a lot harder to find out what exactly, you know, specifically was going on in the day to day of ancient Egypt. But it's very clear that she definitely had a lot of influence in foreign relations and stuff during that time. So
she's also the reason this podcast is not in German.
Thankfully, thanks for Queen TA for keeping us all from speaking German today.
So that was her number one concern.
That was, she was very worried about it.
We do get sucked into a lot of butterfly effect conversations sometimes thinking about if these two hadn't met in, 1300 BC, what would be different now? We wouldn't have vending machines or something.
Yeah.
it would be something very, I love those conversations because the further back in time you go, the smaller and stranger and more specific the thing can become, you know?
Definitely.
Like
definitely.
Crocs, if you think about it, Genghis Khan.
Sure.
Just think about it. Don't say no yet. Think it through. This has been such a blast. I cannot wait to hear those episodes of Ridiculous Romance. They do come out twice a week. And Noel, I thought we did all right on this one. What do you think, man?
I think we did. We had two solid episodes out of it, too. And like you said, Ben, kind of a tour around the world. We got to do this again, you guys. This is super fun.
Oh, and it's such a blast.
I certainly learned a lot, and I will definitely sound a little smarter at the next party I go to, which I think we're going to be going to together. I think we're all going to a podcast conference thing in Nashville. The whole Ridiculous crew. Really excited about that.
Very excited for that.
I can't wait.
And we hope to have you guys on our show soon, too.
Yeah, that would be so fun.
Yeah. Anytime. Well, thanks again to Eli and Diana from Ridiculous Romance. You can find that show everywhere you get your favorite podcasts. Huge thanks to super producers Casey Begram, super producer Max Williams, Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
Big, big thanks to Christopher Hasiotis, to our research associate, Gabe Luzier, and to, of course, we will say his name this time because we haven't met our Beetlejuice rule yet, but thanks to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister. I imagine that he has a few weird courtship rituals of his own, as stories, as anecdotes. I'm not accusing the guy of anything.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.